Welcome to Manage Your Money God's Way, presented by Compass Catholic Ministries. We teach what the Bible shows us are the best ways to manage the money that God has provided us. And we do this in our small group Bible study, Navigating Your Finances God's Way. Check it out by going to CompassCatholic.org. My name is Steve Holbrook, and today, John Bean and I are going to give you part two of our special edition of Manage Your Money God's Way. John and I recently spoke to a certified financial planner. His name is John Kennedy from Candor Path Financial, and we were discussing the benefits of seeking counsel, in this case, the benefits of having a financial planner. In part one, we discussed the types of questions that you should be asking when interviewing financial planners, and as John recommended, you should interview at least three. He also shared on how to judge which one will be the right one for you. And if you missed part one, we have it available at CompassCatholic.org. On the homepage, just scroll down and click on the word podcast. Well, today we're going to spend some time on the benefits of a financial planner when it comes to retirement. So, John Bean, let's pick up on that interview.
John, in last week's segment, you were talking about questions that we can ask a potential financial planner as we're working with them. And you were talking about planners that are working at a level below a typical index. And you mentioned the S&P index. And I know there's world indexes and different indexes that can be used as measuring yardsticks against the performance of your own portfolio. Is it important to understand what the financial planner is using as a yardstick, a measuring stick against their performance?
Yes, it absolutely is, John. And I think on top of that, the beauty with technology these days is that you can fact check a lot of this information via a Morningstar or even like a Google Finance and research, okay, you know, relative to if the goal is to be in a 60-40 portfolio, you can look up 60-40 portfolios, you can look up a Morningstar benchmark of that, so you yourself can also get a feel for how is that performed relative to its benchmark. And it really is unique and situational. If someone's 60 and in a 60-40, and then there's another couple that's 60 years old, but they view risk differently, and they're 90% equities, We're going to be using different benchmarks for those two.
That's good to know. Thanks. So we should really understand how our portfolio is going to be mixed when we ask that question. And so that's going to entail quite a bit of discussion, which I think is probably going to be helpful to me as a potential client to understand where the financial planner is coming from.
Absolutely.
So, John, you and your wife have both been through our Navigating Your Finances God's Way class, and you've been through Set Your House in Order. How have these classes influenced your practice and the way you, number one, work with your clients, but also the way you work across the board with handling the fiduciary responsibility that you have?
Yeah, this is a fun question for me, John, because I was actually thinking about this yesterday. And you know this. I'm a certified financial planner. My wife is in the finance industry on the corporate side. I mean, we are numbers geeks. And yet, taking that course was so critical for us going back to that qualitative state of making sure that we're communicating about things as a couple, making sure that we're giving the way that we want to, that we're saving the way we want to. So it really opened my eyes up to working with couples and better understanding that dynamic. I think it's twofold. One, because I personally experienced it with my wife when we did the course, but I also got to see other couples experience it because it's in a group setting.
Right, right.
And so it really was neat for me to take some of those principles and apply that and maybe just understand the emotional or the situational awareness rather of working with a couple and being able to help them work through a situation, whatever that may be.
So even being a financial planner, mm-hmm. It sounds to me like you actually learned some things about financial planning. Or at least your own personal money management and things you should be doing based on the class that would be helpful to all of our listeners?
I think so, but the part that I can't downplay, it was so critical, was the communication aspect.
Yes.
Because going back to what we talked about at the last meeting, prior to that, my wife really kind of viewed me as the we always joke, like I'm the CFO of the family and she's the CEO of the family. And so she always viewed, you know, me as sort of the financial one, and I sort of took that responsibility. And then I realized, no, wait a minute, that is backwards. I mean, we need to be communicating and making all these decisions together. I can't make a unilateral decision about where money should be saved or spent or given, right? So that it was the most critical aspect for me, was the communication between my spouse and I.
And, you know, I think that's an important message because, you know, we've done some studies over the years, and one of the things that couples have told us, 78% of the time, they tell us that taking the class strengthened their marriage because it gave them a platform to talk about money, which can be an ugly topic between couples if they're not on the same page, and it's something that they can be fighting about. You spent too much on this or that or whatever. But when you go through the class, it gives you a platform to talk about these things in a non-confrontational way.
I'm glad you said it that way. I'm glad you used the word platform, because I can tell you without a doubt, myself and many other couples, if we had committed to saying, okay, we're going to sit down together in our own kitchen with, you know, with nobody else as a facilitator, no other couples there, and we're going to talk about our finances, or we're going to go through the coursework together but not actually take that course with other people, the outcome would have been different. And the reason for that is there's just that accountability that's there by going to the courses, by meeting with the facilitator. And it truly is in a non-confrontational way. I don't know how to explain it, but it just seemed to bring out more conversation around money for us that we just otherwise wouldn't have had.
Okay, in the time that we have remaining, I'd like because on the last show, we talked about getting started with saving and investing, the importance of saving and investing. Let's talk about and focus in on retirement. Mm-hmm. I guess, and I think John and I already know the answer to this question. At what age do I start saving for retirement?
Right now. Right now.
My first day of my
yesterday.
First job.
Yeah. The day that you're ready and prepared to ask that question means it should have been yesterday. Absolutely. And I just don't think you should wait once you're thinking about that. And that, yeah.
Because I'm young, I'm 30 years old. And so how can I save for retirement and save for college? So how's that all done?
It's difficult. You know, you prioritize a litmus test of things that matter for the situation that you're in that life. For my wife and I, we focused really hard on being able to save 20% of our gross income. Now, that's an aggressive number, and it sounds like a lot, and it is. When we first started that, it was much easier. You know, we were in our early 20s. We didn't have children yet. Our bills were much lower. And so saving 20%, although I say it's much easier looking back, but in that moment, the stress was relative to that time, and it was difficult. But what I've learned is once we were able to commit that percentage, as our life grew, as we've changed careers, as our responsibilities have gotten bigger, we've been able to keep that 20% commitment for the savings goal. And we just don't really look back. It's, you know, it's just sort of part of our plan now, and it's what we do. And I think, honestly, the most important thing you can do is find what that percentage is relative to your situation. Meaning, if you're starting this at 45 versus 35, that percentage simply needs to be higher. Mm-hmm. And so what I'd like to do, I'm going to provide a checklist for you guys to put in the show notes. So that you've got sort of a quick list to look at based on some assumptions, and I'll give you some of that data. But you could say, okay, you can kind of use a sliding graph and say, well, if I earn $60,000 a year and I'm 35 years old, here are the percentages that I really need to be focusing on savings, or here's how much I should already have saved for retirement.
So when you meet with the couple, mm-hmm. are you getting into retirement, and let's say, again, they're in their early 30s. You start talking to about them about retirement if they have no plan already in place.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And will you work with them on what percentage they should be looking at?
Yes. Yes. And what's interesting is that the litmus test for me is always, of course, making sure we have the right emergency bucket, and then making sure that if we have the ability to add to things like 401ks, goodness gracious, at the very least, we need to make sure that we're getting the match, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you guys have probably talked a lot about that with other people. I mean, making sure that you're maximizing the benefits that your employer is giving you. That could be putting money in a 401k or some type of, you know, another type of retirement plan. That could even be an HSA. A lot of employers now are moving towards the direction of doing matching for, up to $1,000 or $1,500 into something like an HSA, which all of this ties in. That percentage I mentioned earlier,
right,
that 20% for us, that's going towards a multitude of vehicles. It's not just going into a retirement account. It's going into HSAs. It's going into an emergency bucket. It's going into adding extra to our mortgage.
Can you explain HSA?
That was going to be my question. Yeah. There's a lot of people out there who don't know what that means.
I don't think I've ever heard that.
I'm sorry.
The HSA.
So the HSA is a health savings account.
Oh, okay.
And that is tied to a high deductible health plan. And essentially what an employer will often do, or what we're seeing anyway with a lot of employers now, is if you go with the high deductible health plan, it's a lower cost plan. It's certainly not for everybody. Mm-hmm. But if you do that, you have the ability to fund money into a vehicle that is, it's a triple threat in terms of the tax advantages. It's a tax deduction on the front end. It grows tax-free and it's used tax-free. So the easiest way I can explain it is, think of it like marrying a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA into one vehicle, mm-hmm. but it's for health purposes.
So for health purposes, healthcare expenses.
Right. Correct.
I mean, are the rules pretty defined as what it can and cannot be used for?
Correct. Yes.
Now, will it roll over in most cases? If I don't use it this year, it continues to roll over?
Yes, that's a good question. So it does indeed roll over. There's a difference between a HSA, a health savings account, and a flex spending account, which is an FSA from an employer.
Okay.
Sometimes those plans are use it or lose it. So it's worth making sure that we're looking
into. Ask questions.
Yeah, yep. I think that's a really important thing, because I know when that type of a program would have been beneficial for me, it was a use it or lose it. To me, that never made any sense,
right,
because even though it's coming out tax-free, if you don't use it, you've lost it. You know, there's no value in that.
Of course not. Yeah, of course not. And one other thing I'd like to make mention to, we're seeing more and more employers do this. It's still not very common, but it's in the last couple of years, it's gaining momentum, is that an employer will offer an incentive program for paying down student loans. So kind of going back to this conversation we just had about, if you're in your early 30s, let's say, and you're talking about planning for retirement, well, listen, we all know that financial independence and financial freedom, that doesn't happen unless we're debt-free. I mean, that's part of this conversation too. And so for many, many Americans who are in their 20s and 30s, they have student loan debt. Mm-hmm. And to have an incentive by your employer, almost kind of like a 401k or an HSA match, where they're basically putting matching contributions into debt pay down. It's a very new concept, but we're hearing more and more about it. And I'm fascinated by that idea, because if you gave me the extra motivation and said, hey, John, here, we've got, you know, a 401k you can add to, an HSA you can add to, and your debt pay down, and we're going to help contribute to all those things. Goodness gracious. I mean, we need to take advantage of every opportunity. And
absolutely. And if the employer is going to match some of your funds, that's free money.
Yeah.
And that doesn't count against your income.
And so, I can never understand why some employees refuse to take advantage of that, even though they knew it was free money, the tax advantages. You know, the people that had worked for me, I can never understand why they never wanted to participate.
I would say it goes back to that counsel of a good financial advocate for someone's situation. I mean, that's just not something that we could ever let slide in working with somebody. It's just, it's such a huge critical advantage that I think it's hard to pass up.
Well, you know, the other thing is that very few people really understand, maybe my employer is going to match 6%. 5 or 6% is, I think, probably pretty typical. And so a lot of people will get in and they'll do 1% or 2% thinking, well, that's all I can afford to do. And they don't really understand that if they went for the full max, if they got 5% or 6% instead of that 2 or 3%, it really doesn't affect their take-home pay that drastically, because that money is reducing their taxes.
Yeah, pre-tax. Yeah.
And so their tax bill is going to be less. And so the amount of money that comes out of their take-home pay is really not that drastic.
I would say a fun exercise that I like to apply in that scenario is when we first look through a couple's finances and we're determining that savings rate, that savings percentage, and we try to match what that number needs to be for what their goals are, what their age is, and things of that sort. And it's not meant to be an exercise of embarrassment, or because a lot of people don't like looking at that number once we add everything up. My advice has always been, listen, that percentage is what it is. Leading up to today, that number is that number, regardless of whether you want to see it or you're going to choose to ignore it, it still exists, right? And so we find out what that percentage is relative to the target percentage we're trying to hit. So let's pretend, for argument's sake, the national average now is, it always hovers somewhere around 5%. I think it's actually slightly less than 5% is the national average that people are saving as a percentage of their paycheck. So let's pretend someone's at 5 and the goal is to get them to 15. Well, we know that's not going to happen overnight. That's a hard exercise to do. So we say, okay, well, over the next 12 to 24 months, we help create benchmarks around what that should look like. We make it tolerable steps to get to that point. Because that's easy for me to say, right? You know, yeah. I'm looking from the outside looking in saying, hey, this is the percentage you need to hit, make it happen. Everyone's going to be overwhelmed by that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It takes time. And sometimes it's, you know, hey, listen, you're going to get a merit increase in the next few months. When you have your performance review and you might get a 3 to 5% increase, or you might get a bonus, let's take that percentage and apply that to that savings rate. We can't just focus on the savings percentage. We need to look at what the expenditures are as well.
So John, what do you tell an individual, let's say they're late 40s, early 50s, and they really haven't saved enough for retirement? What's the thing called catch up? Will that help get them to at least a place where they'll feel more comfortable in retirement?
Only if you add mustard.
Well, yes and no. I think it's a good opportunity that there's IRS guidelines around catch up, so that if you're over the age of 50, you can add more to things like IRAs and 401ks. That's all great, but you yourself still have to have the capacity to be able to do that. So if yes, we're given that ability to add more, now we just have to take advantage of it. And I think that's the harder part.
Now, someone who has a 401k with their employer, will you help advise them in what direction they should be placing their funds?
Yeah. I mean, I believe that if nearly every decision you make has financial implications, and certainly your 401k for many people,
right,
that's one of their biggest nest eggs, the biggest pots of money, their home and their 401k. And so, yeah, we need to make sure that that's optimized as well. It's invested correctly and the right percentages are going in there and that type of thing.
Can we talk about the difference between a standard qualified IRA and a Roth IRA? I know that, you know, a 401k might be a Roth, might be classified as a Roth,
yeah,
or it might be just classified as a standard qualified plan. But what's the difference to me as an investor between having a standard qualified IRA and having a Roth IRA?
Yeah. Well, what's great about that question is you didn't lead with, is a Roth IRA better? Because I hear a Roth IRA is better. Because that's oftentimes what I get from people is that they'll come into a meeting and say, yeah, we're putting money in a Roth. We don't know why. We were just told it's better.
You want me to ask you that question?
No, that's okay. but what's funny about it is that it's circumstantial, just like anything else. You know, oftentimes if we're younger, the advice is, you know, so let's say 40 and younger, the advice is to consider a Roth IRA. But the main reason behind that advice is because in theory, we're in a lower tax bracket, right? We still have room to grow in terms of our salary and income. And so the purpose for that advice is let's get the tax deduction in something that's a qualified 401k or a traditional IRA later when we're earning more. That's why we hear that a lot. But fundamentally, the difference is with a traditional IRA, a traditional 401k, you're getting a tax deduction on the front end when the money goes into that account. It grows tax deferred. And then when you go to take the funds out, per the IRS, it's 59.5 in an IRA, it's 55.5 in a 401k. When you go to take those funds out, they are taxed at your ordinary income bracket. With a Roth IRA, you get no tax deduction on the front end, and then it grows tax-free, and you can take the money out tax-free. So for many people, I often like the combination of both, because it gives you tax diversifying advantages on the back end when you're in retirement. And, you know, maybe you have an anomaly year between pensions and consulting work and something else that pushes your income higher on paper, but you want to take a Roth IRA distribution that year so that you're not artificially increasing what your taxable income is. So
both the qualified plan and the Roth plan have maximums that you can contribute on an annual basis.
Mm-hmm.
But they're individual and not additive. I don't even remember anymore what the IRA max is. It's like $6,000 or mm-hmm. something. And a Roth is maybe $5,000. I can contribute six and five if I have the capability to save that much money.
No, actually, okay. you can't
That's
do that.
That's why I asked
yeah.
the question.
So yeah, in 2019, they increased the max contributions to $6,000. But you could, in theory, assuming... And definitely you want to make sure you talk with a tax consultant to make sure that your income's within the right thresholds to do this type of thing.
Right.
But in theory, you could do 3 and 3 if you were trying to split it up. So you could do 3,000 in one and the other for a total of 6,000, but you cannot go over 6,000 in an IRA.
In a combined. Correct. Whether it's our standard qualified or a Roth.
Correct. Yes.
That's the maximum. Now, mm-hmm. if I'm over 50, I can do the catch-up part of that.
Correct. Yes.
And so that increases it. You're saying that I want to have a 15% or a 20%, you know, you're going to advise somebody in order to get to the numbers that you need when you retire, you got to start saving this much. Then the, only a part of that's going to be in any kind of an IRA, 401k, mm-hmm. the rest of it going to be in just after tax investments.
Yeah. So we want to make sure we're maximizing all those vehicles, right? So we go through the litmus test of, okay, great. We've identified the percentage that makes sense for our scenario. Now, where are we going to allocate those percentages? Mm-hmm. So things like 401ks, making the determination of a Roth versus a traditional is a really important conversation. HSAs, like I mentioned, mm-hmm. paying down high interest rate loans that someone might have, that's really critical, right? If someone's carrying a credit card balance, we know that needs to be taken care of.
John, in the last minute we have available,
sure.
is there a rule of thumb how much I should have saved for retirement when I'm, by the time I'm 45, 50, 55? I mean, is there a benchmark or rule of thumb I should look at?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it is relative to the amount of income that we make, because that will oftentimes ultimately dictate the type of retirement that we want to have as well. So if someone, let's say, you know, I'm looking at this retirement savings checklist. If someone is 55 years old and they make $90,000 a year, up to that point, what this suggests based on some of the model assumptions that we'll put in the show notes, they should have saved somewhere around 5.8 times what they've earned, you know, that $90,000, which roughly equates to $486,000. So that's a big number.
Especially considering that the average family only has $100,000 or less.
Yeah.
That's a huge number.
Yeah.
Because
and so
people aren't saving.
Yeah, and so if we're at that age and that's the income that we're making, we're either going to have to make adjustments in retirement and live on less, or we're going to have to step up the percentages between now and the time that we retire. But I'll provide those savings checkpoints for you guys. So it's a great reference point to kind of just get a feel for where you are based on age and income.
I'm sure after catching either last week's show or the one today, you get a sense of the importance of seeking godly counsel, especially when it comes to your finances. And as John said in last week's show, interview at least three financial planners before you make a decision on which one you will be working with. Now, all the information, the resources that John Kennedy mentioned, they are available on our website, compasscatholic.org, and click on blog and look for the blog titled The Benefits for Using a Financial Planner. And before we leave you today, we do have time for one question. We received this email this week. John and Evelyn, how can I improve my credit score? A question a lot of people would love to know.
The best thing you can do to raise your credit score is to pay your bills on time. The second thing is to keep your credit balances low, so quit using those credit cards. The third thing is don't open any new credit accounts. The fourth is to pay off your debt rather than moving it around from credit card to credit card.
And when we talk about keeping your credit balances low, what we're saying is you need to keep them down around 10% of your total credit amount. So if you've got a credit maximum of $10,000.
On all your credit cards.
On all of them. Yeah, mm-hmm. But on anyone in particular, okay, mm-hmm. You don't want to go over $1,000. $1,500 would be absolute max, and that'll help raise your score.
John and Evelyn, there's a lot of listeners out there today saying thank you for that response. Now, if you have a financial challenge and you would like some advice from John and Evelyn, by all means, send your question or questions. They'll take as many as you send. The email address is ask@compasscatholic.org. That's ask@compasscatholic.org. And for John and Evelyn Bean, she will be back next week. We want to thank you so much for listening. And remember and tell a friend. They will have a brand new podcast available each and every Wednesday morning. Simply go to compasscatholic.org, click on the button that says podcast. Not only will you find this one, but you'll find part one, and then you'll find an archive of all the shows that we've done. Again, the website is compasscatholic.org. This is Manage Your Money God's Way.